We have plenty of time for questions. No solos, if that's all right. Carl has the mic. Could you wait for the mic and also hold it horizontally? And I'll let Tyler field the questions.
Thank you. There's one in front.
Yes?
Great.
A couple of questions.
Obviously, you've thought about TRIPS, the whole international, property, intellectual property rights issue. And from the perspective that you're coming from, could you tell us a little bit more about what you think about all that?
Well, as you know, the United States is a significant exporter of culture. And many countries, most notably China, do not always respect our intellectual property rights. So a movie will come out, and within a week, you can buy a copy of it on DVD for a dollar in the streets of China. This, I think, is unfair to the people who made the movie. But that being said, had they had to pay full price, they probably wouldn't have bought it anyway. So is there really much of a loss to Hollywood? I think in the current moment, there's not. And it hasn't stopped us from making movies. The percentage of revenue that comes from the world market has risen steadily over time. Now it's slightly over 50%. So it has not stopped the business model of relying on overseas markets. I do think there's a general cautionary note that we should keep our eye on it and ask countries such as China not to let it get out of hand, and it will become more important as China becomes wealthier. But I'm not especially worried about it. I think it's a lot of unfairness, but in practical terms, it's not that big a deal. It's nothing to get too upset about, at least not at the current moment. So that would be my answer. You said you had more than one question, or?
Well, I was also kind of thinking about the whole perspective of kind of coming from the left or from the more kind of cultural preservation, invasion of traditional cultures perspective about how you relate to that. I mean, I'm sure you know what I'm referring
sure.
to, if I can just kind of shorthand it.
See, I think there are no traditional cultures. Some people now, they call reggae traditional Jamaican culture, keeping in mind there was not even a Jamaican recording industry before 1951. And when reggae first came along, some of the most bitter opponents of reggae were Jamaicans, especially older Jamaicans who said, this is horrible, it's ruining traditional Jamaican music, can't we have our quadrille dance back, what happened to Mento, where is Calypso gone? And now every Jamaican, well not every Jamaican, but most Jamaicans identify with reggae as a kind of national music. So what's a traditional music, what's not? I think it's all relative, I think it changes. Every traditional music was not too long ago the new upstart on the block. Music is changing all the time. And one thing I do in my book is look at a lot of the so-called traditional musics around the world and show that they have relatively recent origins, or the result of trade, result of contact with other countries, other cultures. And in that sense, they're not traditional at all. So the best way to preserve things is to let people make a buck selling them, putting them on disc, CD, record, cassette, whatever, and then let the next style come along as well. Yes?
I'd like to have your thoughts about clashes of culture. For example, all of your records dealt with the male and female being fairly equal. They sang together. They sang about love and so forth. What happens when it collides with a society in which men and women dancing together is deemed sexually degenerate? That's the problem with America, for example, or the Western world in the Muslim world. They're regarded as the great Satan, not because they're imperialists or exploiters, but because they regard the equality of the genders differently than is regarded in Islamic or fundamentalist Islamic societies. I'd just love to have your thoughts about that.
I think there's much to what you say. The question is, what's the most likely solution? And I think the most likely solution is more globalization rather than less. But trying to turn the clock back won't work anyway. And, let's hope those countries, those cultures, those regions, wherever they may be, are willing to adopt what you could broadly call more liberal attitudes. I'm not suggesting that we should all fall in line with exactly the same attitudes we have in this country. Those may not be ideal either. But I think certainly something far better than what they do now, and they could do it if simply they chose to. And if American popular culture gives them the decisive push, I'd say so much the better for American popular culture. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
You use the term synthetic.
Yes.
And also in your book. I don't know exactly what you mean by that, and what would its opposite be, as you're remarking about culture?
When I call culture synthetic, I mean it's a blend of many different influences from different countries, different regions, different styles. So, you know, taking reggae, it was kind of Ethiopian ideology, Jamaican religion, British sea chanties, American doo-wop, native Jamaican rhythms with the offbeat and the upbeat. All of those things put together, that's synthetic. If you had a cultural style that started in one place and didn't draw much on trade or outside influences, that would be a kind of monoglot culture. It's hard to find those. The closest I found in the world of music is the music of the Australian Aborigines, which is, there's no documentation, of course, but as far as anyone can tell, it evolved pretty much on its own. That was the only example of a musical culture I could find that was not synthetic.
And you talk about promoting culture and the advantages in doing that. And I think in your book you say something about there are disadvantages in doing it too. Why would somebody what would be their motive for not promoting culture in the negative of discouraging it, you said? And would it be done by whom? By the private sector, by governments, by what?
Some people, they produce culture, art, music, whatever, and they don't want to promote it that much. One simple reason is that promoting what you're doing costs money. And the more you spend on marketing and promotion, the harder it is to cover your costs. So in any style or genre, you'll see a fairly large number of artists that just do their own thing, and they're pretty content to serve a small or niche audience. They're not promoters. Those people, of course, always have a harder time financially because, by definition, they're not selling that much. But still, if we ask the question, what system gives them the best chance of making any living at all, they actually have the best chance under a kind of mass culture, which has a marketing network that if maybe there's 500 buyers for a CD, mass culture enables those 500 people in a way to come together and buy that CD and fund it and get it produced. So in classical music, you'll have a reissue of a historic concert. Maybe 500 or 600 people will buy it. It will turn a tiny profit, but it comes out. So those minority tastes, it's not marketed, it's not advertised, there's no commercial during the Super Bowl, but it's because we have advertising, superstores, highways, Amazon.com, that those niche releases are able to make any money at all. Yes? I'm not even sure.
Thank you very much for this presentation. It was just right for today's weather and everything. My memories of Jamaican music from my youth, reggae is very, very strongly associated in my mind with marijuana, ganja. And I'm just wondering, since we don't have free trade in that, what would your comment be on that relationship?
Well, I think Bob Marley, in a way, has had excessive influence. Remember when I said I'm not going to play you any Bob Marley because all of you know him? I really did that very deliberately. Much as I love Bob Marley, I think it's somewhat overexposed. And when people think of reggae, they think of Bob Marley. And to me, Bob Marley is not even the best artist in reggae. And he's only one style. He's only one image. And Bob Marley very much cultivated this image of being a pot smoker. But reggae music as a whole does not communicate that image. And a lot of reggae is quite anti-violence, anti-gang, pro-traditional values, pro-romance, pro-work ethic, pro-trying to get by on a limited income, pro-freedom, pro-liberty. So as you'd expect from a large and growing musical form, reggae is pretty diverse. And, you know, I'm all for legalizing marijuana, but I think it's a shame marijuana and reggae have been so tightly associated, because it's a link that's not really there. It's more Bob Marley. It's as if all someone knew of rock music were the Grateful Dead, and they thought all of rock music was like that. Well, some of rock music is, to be sure, not just the Grateful Dead, but it's hardly what rock music is about in a broader sense. So I think it's a question how this association came about. I think it's in part this country has a lot of pot smokers, and they wanted some kind of idol, and they picked Bob Marley. And that was good for Bob Marley, but in a way, bad for some of the other Jamaican artists. A good Jamaican artist with great music and traditional values would be Luciano, if you want to, you know, listen to someone for contrast. I don't think I have any on me, but there's plenty there. Yes?
I think we're being a little bit too glib when we say that all art is synthetic. There are cultures that are isolated from the rest of the world, and they have been many more in the past than there are now because of the pervasive nature of mass media and mass culture, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's a whole squadron of ethnomusicologists that went around the United States for 30 years, from the 30s through the 60s, making recordings of one village in Kentucky that had a specific kind of fiddle playing, et cetera, et cetera. And those evolved apart from the recording industry. Furthermore, it's also, I think, a little bit too simple to think that music doesn't count if it isn't spread by the recording industry. But finally, I want to take a triumphalist interpretation of your ideas and say that our culture, however synthetic it is from other cultures, is still a very powerful and a very saleable and a very dominating culture. And one of my wishes, and I bet a lot of the people in the room feel the same way, is that as our media gets more and more penetration into the Muslim world, our values, such as equality for women, will penetrate into that world, and those women eventually will want to shed their funny garments that cover their whole bodies and break free, and that will be the vanguard for freedom in those cultures and will destroy the orthodox Muslim values that we don't seem to be able to live with and don't want to live with.
There are a lot of different issues in what you say. Let me just address one or two. I researched a lot of these different musics, but I commonly found they were much more synthetic than I had thought. So if you take the Kentucky musics of, you know, the 20s and 30s, they typically drew on Scotch tunes, on Irish tunes, on European styles of fiddling, black blues, gospel, sea songs, all these mixed together in a pretty short period of time. And yes, it was before recording, but they were remarkably well connected musically in many ways. It's not that they were listening to Beethoven or I had rap music on CD, but nonetheless, all these styles formed pretty quickly, and they did so with a lot of trade. I even looked at the Pygmies of Central Africa, who are really awfully remote. There's only 60 to 80,000 of them. They live in, you know, the deepest, darkest jungles of Central Africa, Cameroons and Congo. And it turns out that virtually all Pygmy instruments they got by trading with the Bantu, melodies they picked up from other places. Some Pygmy songs are based on the melody of My Darling Clementine, and so on. But yes, some musics are more or less synthetic, but I found I've been surprised time and again just how much a music needs trade and borrowing to get off the ground, to flourish, to have new ideas. And it's more than I had thought when I went into this project. And in terms of American culture dominating the world, I think in some areas we're stronger than others. You mentioned Muslim cultures. Most of the music they listen to is not American music. They listen to much more music from Algeria and Egypt. And within the so-called Islamic world, there's a lot of complaints of cultural imperialism about Egypt and Algeria, oddly enough. If you go to the Caribbean, the people on the small French islands, they call the Haitians cultural imperialists for exporting their music, you know, to Guadeloupe and so on. Or Indian movies are much more popular in the Middle East than our Hollywood movies. So I think there's room for American culture to have a positive influence, as you suggest. But I think we're pretty far from being dominant in that part of the world.
I don't know whether you want to get away from the arts. Maybe that's where you'd like to keep this. I see the impact of what you're saying, and I travel a great deal, and I see the youth looking pretty much alike in any country I go to. They're all wearing blue jeans, and their girls are cutting them down lower. But there's a long-range view that I see in here. This diversity. This diversity is going to change other things that I don't think people are yet realizing, and that is healthcare delivery and the farming industry, of which I have members of my family who are going out of business because they can't compete with what diversity is doing to them. And I fear, as I listen to you, that this universality of feeling amongst a huge segment of our younger population is going to turn around and bite them right in the butt later on. And an example right now, you can order drugs out of Canada at a fraction of what they cost here, but Canada did none of the research. They rented the formulas from American companies who did it all. They make it up there cheap and sell it back to us, and everybody thinks that's wonderful. But in the long run, our companies that devise all these things are going out of business, as its healthcare delivery is beginning to decline and become much more mediocre. And the farming industry, I have a member of the family who's literally going out of business. He can't even make ends meet. So I think what you're saying is interesting. I fear what the long-range implications of this diversity are going to do to this country. I don't think it will be good.
There are many issues in there beyond the scope of my topic, but I will predict that the price of drugs in Canada goes up. I will predict that the price of drugs in Canada goes up. Yes, Tiber?
I want you to help me resolve a dispute between the Bartok fans and the List fans.
Which are you?
I actually have more sympathy with List, but List is always being dissed for having corrupted genuine Hungarian music and how he made it into a Viennese entertainment medium, and whereas Bartok went to the people and, you know, extracted the true blue Hungarian musicality and so on. What do you think about this? I assume you have had some connection with this debate, so I'm wondering what you think about this. It sort of relates to this issue.
Sure. I'm a fan of both composers, but Liszt actually was the precursor of Bartok in this respect. The 19 Hungarian Rhapsodies really were taken pretty directly from Hungarian folk tunes, and Bartok knew this, and that's what inspired him to do his work. So I think one can side with both and give Liszt the credit for having gone there first. Liszt was a more encompassing synthesizer. German music, French music, Italian music, all the transcriptions, Austrian music. He brought so many different things together, church music, choral music, organ music. He had a broader reach, broader vision than Bartok did. He was, in a way, more European, I think, and less Hungarian. But I think no less authentic in terms of what he did. And keep in mind, those Hungarian folk tunes themselves came from blends of different cultures in Hungary and Eastern Europe, and they themselves have many different sources, and they were evolving all the time.
So in your view, the Bartok wasn't the purist that some people make him out to
Absolutely
be?
Absolutely not. Quite the contrary. Andrew?
Thanks for the talk. I think you raised a lot of interesting questions, as have some of the speakers. And so kind of in thinking about what you said and what a lot of the other questioners have said, it seems like for every good example where two cultures come together and harmoniously, in this case, create kind of a different outcome, there's also as many equally good examples of where cultures have come together and one culture has been destroyed. I think that one of the best examples and probably parallel here is the case of Native American languages, where there are many Native American languages that are kind of been wiped out of existence, and there are others where there's only a handful of people speaking those. And so I wonder if this doesn't raise the question of whether the underlying principle that's governing this is not necessarily that free trade brings beauty, but that free trade can always create a larger market for a single homogenized good, but often at the expense of one of the goods. In the case of the Native American languages, obviously Native American languages are lost when they competed against the English language. In this case, we lost kind of original Jamaican music. There was enough of a market to keep kind of original American music, but we created a larger market for kind of for this reggae. And so I think this kind of comes back to my question of whether you've really answered the question about, or maybe changing the question about globalization and cultural diversity, whether that's good or bad, to a question which I think is probably more appropriate, given your initial thesis, is whether the loss of culture, kind of indigenous culture, maybe that first order indigenous culture, maybe a second or third or fourth or nth order indigenous culture, whether that's a good or a bad thing. Does that make sense?
You raise many issues. I think there are many more examples of gain through cultural trade than of loss. Consider a very gross comparison. Take the world in 1450 and take the world today. There are a whole set of ways in which today's world offers you more. Those are obvious. There are some number of, I would say, a smaller number of ways in which the world in 1450 was more diverse. You had more languages. You had more indigenous cultures. But if you look at how much people were able to enjoy those forms of diversity, it's extremely limited. You have really just about everyone, except the European aristocracy, living under the tyranny of place, having very little choice, really a pretty poverty-stricken menu of cultural consumption. We've moved from the world of 1450 to the world of today. No one would deny that things are lost, but I think there's been much more gain, and I would say as a general principle, the preservation we get is in wealthy societies. Poor societies didn't have musical notation, they didn't preserve their artworks. African artwork would rot or ruin or be lost to climate. More people today know Shakespeare and Mozart and the Bible than ever before. So your best chance of preserving the past over time, or taking advantage of it at any point in time, is to have this growth, have this trade, have a market in preservation. And that will mean letting some things perish. But I think when you look at the balance sheet, it's not an even scale, but there's really a preponderance of creativity, choice, freedom on the side of the modern world and trade. That would be my response.
If I could interject one other point. As further sort of evidence of what Tyler is saying is the fact that most Native American tribes were obviously victims by a campaign to eradicate many tribes, including their culture. In other words, it wasn't just that the U.S. Army went after many different tribes in the West and other things in the East as well. But once the tribe surrendered, the children were put into anglicized schools to obliterate the culture that the people had. In fact, in many instances, it was against the law to actually speak the native language or to wear costumes that were traditional to those tribes. And it's not just true in the U.S., it's true in many other places too. So the fact that it was felt necessary to use coercion to obliterate these cultures was an indication that without obliteration, the cultures might thrive.
The other thing to keep in mind with the American Indian is how much of the American Indian visual arts is pretty recent. So like the huge totem poles in the Northwest, those do not predate the 19th century. It's because the Indians of the Northwest traded furs with the settlers, and they became wealthier, but they built all those things, and they needed metal carving knives, or the crayon drawings of the Plains Indians, or a lot of the basket weaving techniques. You find examples again and again of cultures blossoming, even under difficult conditions where there's extermination and horrible things that none of us would endorse, but cultures blossoming artistically by having some kind of exchange with other cultures. And the things we admire in those cultures very commonly do not predate that period of exchange. Now, you raise the case of languages. I do think language is an example where there's no doubt we will have fewer languages than we used to. It's already happening. I'm not sure if this is a good or a bad thing, but we should keep in mind as more people write and speak English, Spanish, Chinese, French, other major languages, it means they can read the world's literature, they have access to the internet, access to the world's cultural treasures, they can listen to other people and speak to other people in the way they never could have before. So to me it's not obvious that it's a bad thing. I don't know how many languages the world should have. Maybe we'll end up with too few. But I don't think that more languages per se is a good thing either. Yes?
It's interesting that in all of this discussion you haven't mentioned nature once, and I wonder if you could comment on the effect of free trade on natural beauty and biodiversity, because I think a lot of us can think of examples where free trade has enormously accelerated the loss of biodiversity and the loss of natural beauty.
I am not an environmentalist. It's my general sense as an economist that we do not define property rights in nature well enough, and that there is some serious problem that is real and out there. But if you're asking me exactly how to solve it, I just have to tell you I don't know. I've never studied it. I've never written on it. The burden of world culture exhausts me as it is. I think you raise a good point. I think other people should work on it. I don't mean to be Pollyannish about all problems. I think that's a real one.
Actually, life has an ultimate and it's even harder to bring forth because
I don't even know about this project, but I'm told Gary Leibkamp and Olson are writing on this, so they're good economists that might be worth looking at. Yes?
The gentleman made the comment about Muslim culture, and the problem is that I see we export cultural artifacts. We don't export the values that are behind those cultural artifacts. So consequently, conservative Muslims would see men and women dancing together and confuse liberty with license. Since they have none, they think that that's what they're afraid of, because they don't realize that with liberty comes responsibility. But again, when we export songs or musical forms or artwork, it's an artifact, it's a thing. And the culture behind that artifact, blue jeans, record players, video cameras, all these things are things. What created them? What caused them to be created? And that's what we can't export. We can only export the things, the values we have to teach. And hopefully, it's like I was, when I was speaking with you earlier, Dallas was popular abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Not because JR was a good guy, but because here you had people living in wealth that was natural. There was an old Elia Kazan movie, and I don't remember the title, but there's a young Greek boy at the dock calling out to the American freighter, America, America, hoping that they would take him to America. This dream of a better life, without even knowing what it involved, he wanted to go. But he was looking for a value more than a thing, but what we export are things.
I'm not sure how values will evolve in the Middle East, or even if there's any single answer to that question. I know some people make the following argument. They say terrorism has grown because it's losing the battle. It's a kind of desperate rear guard action. I'm not sure that's true, but I don't think we can dismiss that possibility either. Yeah. Yeah. But if we look around the world and we ask, have markets spread? The answer is yes. If we ask, has democracy spread? The answer is yes. Have the people who've adopted those systems been better off? Well, for the most part, it's been a rocky road in some places, but basically yes. So given it's spread and given it's worked better than what was before, why not have a kind of prima facie blind optimism that it will continue to spread and things will go pretty well? I'm not convinced that's true, but I think there's a lot to be said for this prima facie blind optimism that there are gains from trade and they'll be realized and better systems have a pretty big advantage. And the more globalized the world, the more obvious people can see, you know, East Germany, West Germany. Once the people in East Berlin started getting TV, in a way it was all over. It's like, huh? Yes?
Well, actually there is quite a bit of cross-culturalism between the Middle East and European and American countries. For instance, Sting with his song Desert Rose, it's very Arabic. There's a lot of Muslim people who have brought their music to France, and so the whole groove thing with, mm-hmm. So this, I mean, you know, why, you know, focus on places like Saudi Arabia that obviously is very conservative, but Turkey and Algeria and Morocco are quite, you know.
Pretty open, yeah.
Yeah, dancing between men and women, so to point fingers seems kind of silly.
If I could add one little point to that, it's also interesting, I think, to look at the history of Western civilization and the influence that Islamic society had on European society, because after the fall of the Roman Empire, there was a great deal of intolerance throughout Europe, and of course most people lived in incredibly depraved situations, and as Tyler was mentioning, Greek bronzes would be melted down and so on and so forth because of the destitution of the people. And it was the Arabic world that maintained the manuscripts of Greece and Egypt and elsewhere, and then brought that back to Europe through Spain, and as well as bringing mathematics and architecture and many other aspects. And for much of the history of the Arab world was more tolerant of different cultures than was much of Christian Europe, especially for Jews and others who were mistreated, as everyone knows, enormously in European societies, but in much of the Arab world they were not. So the difference here is that to create tolerance, trade is, I think, has an enormous track record of creating ways for people to share ideas.
Yes?
I was a little surprised that you all these folk songs from these various people, because when we talk about music, it's relatively primitive music. I mean, no question about it. I'm surprised that you have not mentioned what happened in Central Europe in the 17th, 18th century, 19th century, creating all this music which we now play all over the world, and which was played in America even during the wars.
Sure.
I mean, that is a cultural impact,
sure,
the like I have not seen in any other thing, except perhaps for some painting. But that's, I would like to hear a little bit how you put that together with those relatively simplistic folk songs.
Well, I think I mentioned last time I gave the talk, it was about Bach and Mozart and Haydn. You know, Haydn made it by traveling to London and selling his music there. Mozart traveled all around Europe. Bach drew on multiple influences. Beethoven sold music all around Europe, toured Europe, went to England, and so on. Liszt was a European composer, above all, Chopin the same. And I could go on about that for 6 or 7 hours or more. I think I own about 4,000 classical CDs and about 1,000 LPs. So I have about 20 different talks I could give on that topic. But I just felt like doing something different tonight. And that being said, I don't think modern musics are more primitive than those musics. I think what's primitive in a music is a very tricky question. If you're asking, could Bob Marley write a fugue? Well, no, not a very good one, at least. But does Jamaican music or British pop music have kinds of sophistication in the studio or with rhythms that classical music did not have? Absolutely. Or take the classical music of India. It has really no harmony, but in terms of rhythm and melody, in many regards, it's far more sophisticated than European classical music. With microtones, it has access to so many more sounds than did Beethoven. So if we compare those two musics, which is more sophisticated, which is more primitive? If we're going to rank them, arguably the European is more primitive. My view is that all these genres are different. There's good and bad within each genre, but the excellent works within a genre really will stand the test of time and be sophisticated in their own way. And the great thing about the modern world is we don't have to decide which is better. You know, we can each choose and buy what we want, listen to what we want. But I'm a great lover of classical music. I have a lot to say about it. And if you look at my music library, it's 75% of what I own, I'd say. So, I mean, that's a great period of time, and maybe it never has been topped. But I think the story doesn't end there either.
Two more questions.
Yes?
As far as I know, your general argument about culture being a syncretic and the product of collision of other cultures is absolutely absolutely on the beam and supported by almost all the evidence from a great variety of arts and music. But I think you may be a little too optimistic and possibly also preaching to the choir here, as though the policy options before us are either to have completely free trade in everything or to have completely restricted trade where we can only listen to music made in our neighborhood. And I think it's worth pointing out some asymmetries that always occur in these exchanges. The American music that was being created and sent to Jamaica for the Jamaicans to react to as they pleased wasn't made with anything in mind, with no conception in mind that here's a song that's really going to sell well to the 2 million people in Jamaica who can't put two nickels together. It was made to appeal to an American audience, and it turned out to speak to Jamaicans in the way it did. Conversely, a lot of Latin American music that came to America was had the corners knocked off it, in some people's view, was possibly improved in other people's view, so that it could be heard by Americans because it was just too far away. I'm thinking of bossa nova, which is kind of a vanilla version of the real Brazilian popular music of the time. That's if I were giving your talk, I would have used Brazilian music and told essentially the same story that you did.
Yeah.
I mean, all of this is true. There's Chinese export porcelain to Europe is very highly thought of and collected in museums. Black velvet paintings in Mexico souvenir shops is not so highly thought of and hasn't, in fact, contributed to, I don't think people would say has contributed much to the culture on either side of the border. And the asymmetry between the size of the consuming and the receiving cultures in these trades makes a lot of difference in whether it really works out as well as it might. And it's quite possible that more sophisticated, tuned-up trade policies. I mean, it might be right for the French to be constantly pushing back against American musical intrusion, but we'd hope they wouldn't completely succeed. But maybe it ought to be a little bit harder for this stuff to get across. I'm sorry for making a speech, but I do want to put a question to you. You said that the satellite that you can get in your car now has this wonderful variety that you can listen to all these different kinds of classical and popular music. I used to be able to listen to a wonderful variety of classical, popular, rock, jazz, and everything else on the radio, and now I can't. In fact, I live in a city, and this is the city that has no real classical music radio station. It's kind of elevator music, classical, and that's it. Why do you think the variety that you now get on the satellite will be stable and persistent when it's disappeared from the airwaves under the administration of Clear Channel and the kind of natural evolution of that market? In all the other media.
There's a lot in there. You start at the end. Consumption of classical music had a huge boost, basically when the CD started being used. So people bought more classical music. It's dipped the last few years, but there's a good 10 or 15 year streak where there was a huge boom in classical music. And if it's fallen, it's because a lot of the core listeners, they've built their core library, and they have it. It's not that they're unhappy, it's that they're happy. They have more than they can listen to. So if we ask, is classical music listening been in a bad way, I think it's exactly the opposite. If you look at what you can get on Naxos for $6 or $7, and often excellent versions, as well as many other labels, what you can download from the internet, what you have access to in other ways, overall access has gone up. Now, why has classical music vanished from the radio? I think overall radio has moved a bit more towards mass taste in a number of ways, and that is exactly what set in motion the incentive for there to be satellite radio. And the reason I think we can be more optimistic about future technologies, be it internet radio, satellite radio, wireless, whatever they think up next, we can't even imagine it right now, is simply because technology is lowering costs. And as you lower costs, you need fewer listeners to support a given market. And over time, you ought to have more choice of classical music. And I think it's what we're seeing. And, you know, go to Best Buy, get satellite radio, get XM. It's great. And furthermore, the sound quality is much, much better than old radio. It makes old radio sound primitive. It's like listening to a CD in your home. And for classical music, sound quality is very important. So, you know, I'd say on that we can all really cheer up. And this satellite radio is just getting started. We don't know where it will go, of course, but I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. And in any case, it's great now. And, you know, here we are now. In terms of asymmetry, I do think it's important how many of the buyers are from America, Jamaica, and so on. But I don't think there's a simple formula. If you look at reggae, the tipping point comes in the late 60s, early 70s, when more than half of the buyers start being U.S. and U.K. And it doesn't mean the death of reggae by any means. Reggae is still alive and well. Maybe now we call it dancehall. It's changed. But it's not less Jamaican. If you look at early Cuban music, often the main patrons of that were North Americans or Europeans. And there was a lot of junk, but there was a lot of great Cuban music. And that's coming back again with this Buena Vista Social Club album and extensions of that. And again, a lot of it's pretty good. So I think you can have quite an asymmetry. And sure, a lot of times it doesn't work out. You get a kind of bland pat. But a lot of times you get some pretty excellent stuff. And I think over time, if the artists have access to the market and can experiment, a lot of the good ones will find their way. And again, I'm cautiously optimistic, but optimistic because I've seen in the past plenty of cases of a gross asymmetry, and you still get a pretty wonderful revolution. If you look at Persian carpets, the buyers for those were 99% foreign, and those are fantastic. It was a complete asymmetry, and I think they're great, classic Persian carpets. I think there's one more question in the back. Yes, this gentleman?
You commented earlier that there are people that said there's too much commercialism and it's destroying the culture. Who are two or three of these mainstream and or prominent people that espouse this view?
On the left wing, read Benjamin Barber. On the right wing, read Alan Bloom. There's also a book by Arthur Herman called The Idea of Decline that surveys the literature. There's a book by Oliver Bennett called Cultural Pessimism. There's the Frankfurt School on the left and my own book in praise of commercial culture that surveys the whole field. But overall, I think there are a lot more cultural pessimists than optimists. I'm a natural contrarian. And I'm also a natural optimist, so the two work together in this case. Anyway, thank you all for coming. If you want to know what any of the music was, you can either ask me or email me afterwards. It's welcome, so.
Thank you very much, Tyler. I want to remind everyone that copies of Tyler's book are upstairs, and as you can tell by the